Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dale, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Now, generally, we don't rush our podcast from recording to publication, but today is Monday the 15th of October, and we're publishing on Wednesday the 17th of October because it's a really interesting time in markets. And when markets really start to move, it's great to get a greater perspective on what's going on and why, and more importantly, what to do about it. Today, I'm talking with Nathan Bell, Portfolio Manager at InvestSmart, who has nearly 20 years' experience as an investment analyst and a portfolio manager, and who brings an international perspective to clearly what are not just movements on the ASX. We'd planned to cover how to manage an aging bull market today, and with recent movements on international markets and the ASX, it seems perfectly timed. Nathan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Gemma.
So, Nathan, can you quickly run us through where we find ourselves now from an equities perspective?
So, in a sense, we've had almost the anniversary, in a sense, for the 10-year bull market, which is now the longest ever. I think it was about 3 weeks ago we passed that official end. But that said, I think the difference with this bull market is there's so much central bank intervention that it's actually hard to call. Is this the seventh innings? Is it the eighth? Or are we right at the end here? And I think maybe we got a little bit of a flavour for it last week. We saw the market come down 2 or 3 days in a row, and it spooked people, and particularly in emerging markets who are really suffering. I mean, people are worried about 5% falls in Australia, and yet some of the stocks in emerging markets and in China are down 30, 40%. So they are actually well into bear market territory. But I think the bull market is still intact, and the US market is still very strong. And if I look at the Australian market, hasn't really had the performance of the US market, which has been, as I said, the longest bull market ever, not the strongest. But if you bought right at the bottom, you know, as if anyone did, but even if you just bought the index, you're up about 3 or 4-fold on your money. So that tells you that it actually has been a fairly strong bull market.
I loved your comment about innings. Howard Marks, who's a super famous investor in the US, distressed debt primarily, from what I can gather, not necessarily equities. But his comments when people ask him is where we are, and he says we're at the bottom of the eighth innings. And he said, the problem is that there aren't 9 innings in a market. So I'll tell you where we are in the number of innings, but we could go to 12. I was like, that's not very helpful, Howard. Come up with a better one, better analogy. As you point out, so Australian investors who've been holding Australian equities over the last 10 years, so that 10-year anniversary is really powerful. They've done well, particularly because if dividends have been so impressive and yields been so good, and as you say, that central bank intervention's been extraordinary. Australian investors who've held international equities, not so much emerging markets, as you point out, but definitely US equities have done incredibly well. And depending on when they bought them, there was a nice little period there when the Australian dollar was incredibly strong, so that would have been very nice. Yeah, they've done super well, but anyone who's been in cash over that period, there's been so much uncertainty. There are plenty of investors who stayed in cash after tax and inflation. They've had a very boring 10 years, right?
Well, I actually wonder whether it's going to get worse, because I think everyone's expecting interest rates to go up in Australia, even though we've been on hold for years now. But if there's any problems with the housing market, I fully expect that the Australian central banks and government will adopt the same playbook that we saw play out in the US. And that is basically, I think the government would backstop some of the wholesale loans that the banks need from foreigners. I think that would be the first thing we'd see. Mm. I think we'd see interest rates head towards zero. Mm. And if things got really bad, I don't see why the Australian Central Bank wouldn't start printing money in the same way that everyone else has. It seems to, for everything bad you can say about it, in a sense, it has worked. I mean, in a sense, it's got markets moving. So if that's the aim, and if it's the aim to get the economy going, then it has worked. I don't think we've seen the full effect of that. I think we're only just starting to see that now. And I think it was actually about 14 days ago was actually the 1 year anniversary of quantitative tightening in the US. And this is really what's driven the fallout in emerging markets. The higher interest rates go in the US, the more money is going to go towards those safer options. And even though the US is one of the most highly leveraged economies in the world, I think we've got twice as much debt in the global system as what we had at the peak of the GFC. People still want to be in what they perceive is the safe options, and that's really why we're seeing CSL, the healthcare stocks, the infrastructure stocks, people are still gravitating to them, even though the valuations are extremely high. And I don't think that's going to change in the meantime, which is why you're seeing situations like China, where there's some wonderful businesses, but anything that's sort of a bit cyclical or there's a little bit of fear around it, people are just exiting that and just going for the safe havens.
That's a super interesting point. So there, extraordinary expansion. Bubble is a really strong word, but asset prices have inflated very dramatically over the last 10 years because, frankly, cash was such a terrible option, right? So you had to go and find anywhere else that you could go and get a better return, and people went all sorts of places to get them. Emerging markets was one of those options. They're now pulling back pretty hard from those markets because they seem far too risky with rising interest rates in the US and all of those sorts of things, and also a stronger US dollar, which is killing people who have huge amounts of debt denominated in US dollars. So when you're looking at it from an Australian equities perspective, we do have plenty of companies that do derive offshore earnings and so on, sometimes in US dollars, sometimes in Australian dollars. How do you think they're going to fare in this kind of environment?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like normally you would say, so Howard Marks you brought up, and he's very, very famous for talking about people having, you've got to have second order thinking. And that's not to look at the obvious, but to really go into the detail and think through these things. And one of those is, I think, let's just take CSL, for example. It earns most of its revenue overseas. And automatically you assume that if the Aussie dollar's going down, they're going to book higher revenues essentially in Australian dollars. That's a good thing. Then automatically you assume that the share price must go up. But as good as this company is, it's already trading on around 36 or 37 times earnings. So how much of that has already been factored into the share price? And I think that's what you have to always think about with your stocks is, it's not what's happened in the past that's going to give you a good return on your shares. It's actually what the market hasn't anticipated. And so I think there a lot of people are looking at emerging market currencies, and they're looking at Australian currency because we are pretty much looped in with China and our resources and commodities and those type of things. And we have our own debt issues to deal with. Growth is going to slow. We've got the Hayne Commission that people are focused on. People are exiting the banks. And we're seeing foreigners walk out of the banks. We're actually seeing more shorts put on the banks, so more foreign investors anticipating more falls in the bank share prices. So all of this is pushing Aussie dollar down. It's not a surprise. What it means for some of these bigger companies, I'm not 100% sure, because the valuations are so high already. And I know people, as I said, people are going into the safe havens, but I think you might actually do better. I don't own James Hardie in our portfolios at the moment. It's one I'm thinking a lot about. But James Hardie is a good example of a very high quality business that's listed in Australia but has most of its money made in the US. And what we've seen recently is the home builders, the US home builders. And there's a really extraordinary company in that group that I really like, very safe. It's bought back about 80% of its shares over the last 20 years, which is highly unusual for that industry.
Yeah.
And the company's NVR. But NVR and all these other companies have been downgraded recently because they're starting to see signs of the US housing market slow. So James Hardie, which normally trades at...
That's not getting a lot of press.
No, it's not.
Which is interesting.
Particularly in Australia. I don't know whether people are just more focused on Australia at the moment, but it's...
We're very interested in our own housing market. We're not worried about other people's. Yeah.
It's funny because you talk about the average price of a home in America is only about $350,000 or $400,000. And you go, well, how can it possibly be affordability issues? But again, it's a very regional thing. Obviously, those prices aren't in San Francisco and New York, where most of the population wants to live. But it's just interesting you're seeing this cyclical company get downgraded. So James Hardie normally trades at a large premium to the average stock on the ASX, and now it's actually trading, I think, a slight discount or maybe in line. So these are the sort of opportunities I think are more interesting for investors to look at rather than the obvious safe havens like a CSL.
That's it's a really interesting point. You did make some comments about the Australian housing market and bank exposure. So we've seen from NabTrade investors, and it's been really interesting to watch. So NabTrade investors, when we started looking at this data a few years ago, the bulk of their portfolio was in financials. And when I say the bulk, I mean it could be as high as 60% in five stocks and then sort of a long tail of other bits and pieces. CSL was always in the top 10 as well. But very heavily overweight financials, particularly our SMSFs. We know more than half of all SMSF assets are in pension phase. So the yield really mattered. So there were very strong reasons for being in that part of the market, but they were predicated on an assumption of stability and being able to continue to pay really strong dividends and all of those sorts of things. And over the last maybe 3 months, it's not terribly long, we've seen a really significant shift away from financials, with investors trimming, not selling wholesale, but trimming their positions and trying to work out what else to rotate into, trying to look for opportunities outside financials because clearly they're a little bit nervous about longer term growth potential, but even sustainability potential in that sector. What are your thoughts about that?
So the way I've treated banks, so I look after two portfolios. I've got a growth portfolio and an income portfolio.
Oh, okay. So you know these guys well, yeah.
So I don't have any banks in the growth portfolio. We've got a few fund managers, Platinum Asset Management, a couple of these types. In the income portfolio, it's very hard to offer a market yield with the fund, which is what we promise, or above, without having some bank exposure. So I've recently upped our exposures to the bank, but it's because we had such a low exposure before. So I've only returned to InvestSmart after 3 or 4 years working on the international fund. And I used to work at Intelligent Investor, and my policy on the banks was always is the same today as it was back then, which is I always preferred Macquarie, CBA and Westpac. I just thought it was a much better group than having ANZ and NAB in there as well. I think over time, if you looked at the returns, Commonwealth and Westpac have been far superior. But again, we're at the tail end of the cycle. I don't know how much left there is in Macquarie. It's not to say that they can't get going up, but I remember recommending that during the GFC. I think I was one of only, maybe it was myself. maybe there was one other analyst, maybe. At $18 a share.
I was going to say $16.50. Did it get down to? I remember that. NAB was also down at $16.50. $16.50 seemed to be the number at which things could get to, and then everyone went, yeah, that's probably low enough now.
Well, that's a great point, because I remember one of the first stocks I bought was National Australia Bank, when all seven central banks have done everything they can to boost property prices. You know, how much money are they going to make in the future when all of a sudden there's pressure on profit margins if interest rates go up, or conversely, if credit growth slows and people aren't willing to buy the second or third investment property anymore? That's really the segment I'm particularly worried about. It's not people who are in their homes. They tend to have fairly good equity across the board, but people who have taken on two or three investment properties, if I was to tell you I could buy a stock, you could buy a stock today, it traded on 33 times earnings, it paid a 2%, about 2.5% dividend yield that's not going to grow, and you had to leverage into that stock at 80 to 100%.
Yeah.
Now, people, if I told you to buy that stock, people would think I was absolutely crazy. What the hell are you doing as a portfolio manager? And yet, that's the maths of an investment property. And the only reason people are willing to subscribe to that is because of that belief that property prices only go up. And of course, there's a few tax deductions in there, which make it a little bit more interesting. But when there's that belief that, is going to come at some point, I don't know whether we're on the way there or not, but when people believe the capital gains are no longer there to justify paying those prices, and we've got 1/6 of all mortgages in this country are interest-only loans to investors, to me, you've got 1% of the property market gets turned over each year. That's going to have, I think, an enormous impact on the prices people are prepared to pay for homes, and that's really going to slow the credit growth, slow the earnings growth, and slow the dividends of the big banks.
That's I think investors would be really interested in that one statistic. So you said 1/6 the interest only. So that's very interesting. About 3 years ago, I think, the statistic was 40% of the entire book was, so it's dropped pretty dramatically then. Things are starting to roll off. So it was from 40% down to 1/6.
So the 1/6 is only the investor interest-only loans.
So so that doesn't count the owner-occupied.
That's right. So it's about 30% or low 30s if you add those in.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so that's quite terrifying when you think about it. Because the one that blew my mind, you like Westpac, was that at that point in time, again, 2 to 3 years ago, Westpac's entire book was 50% interest-only. That is the most astonishing statistic I have ever heard in the history of looking at equities, I think, was 50% of their book was interest only. I was like, it's also astonishing that investors and homeowners to that extent were willing to take that kind of risk, that they had so much confidence in the property market that they were like, oh, damn it, I won't pay it off, it's fine. I'll just pay the interest at 3.5% because interest rates also never go up and it'll be fine.
Well, that's a perfect point, because the thing is, when people go to borrow money, they don't think about, okay, I could borrow, say, $500,000 and I could do that comfortably. People go along to their bank manager and go, how much is the most I can possibly borrow?
Yeah. Yes, give me the most you've got. Yeah.
And then as soon as they make a bit of a dent in that, they start looking for the next property. And I think that's what makes it particularly risky. And I'm not sitting here saying we're going to have a collapse. I don't know how it's going to play out. It could be 10 or 15 years of just flat prices as incomes catch up slowly. And I think the government and the central banks would be praying for that sort of outcome. You know, what they do, you know, or if it's a 10 or 15%, which seems to be the market consensus at the moment, you know, it keeps going up every sort of month from 10 to 12.
Yeah, yeah, just edging higher. Yeah.
But if it's slow, I think that's okay. And particularly if you're a bank shareholder, that would be okay too, because if you saw Wells Fargo in the US, which was the one that performed best through the GFC, it was really allowed to earn its way through the GFC. So if you can spread out the losses, which is essentially what the government and the central banks are trying to help the banks do, then they can get through those bad loans. What they really don't want is that very fast, rapid fall in prices and the massive increase in bad debts, because you just don't have a chance to earn through it if you've got 12 or 18 months of bad debts that you're not provisioned for. And again, the government central bank will do their bit. I think the four banks, the reason I favour the four banks over the regionals, even though they're statistically cheaper, is because I feel the government will help them out first in a really, really bad scenario. And I know Commonwealth and Westpac get picked on as the ones with the most residential mortgage exposure, and they're also statistically the highest price. But I think it's worth, particularly in a late stage stock cycle, whether it's the banks or just stocks generally, you want to be in the quality. It's worth paying for the quality. And the reason is I still remember going to the last meeting that Timbercorp had in 2008 or 9.
Would have been the last meeting, yeah.
And they weren't fessing up, but it was like, I was down in Melbourne and it was like going to a funeral. There was just, like, it felt that bad. You could just feel it in the air. And I had no investments personally in it, but we'd made, unfortunately, some recommendations in that space. But people weren't just in the ordinary equities, they were also in the income securities, which they thought had a lot more protection. And I think this is particularly important for people today who are in things like hybrids, that they don't necessarily understand the exposure, because what you've really got is equity-like exposure, but fixed income-like returns. So to me, that's sort of always kept me away from them. Like, at least if you're going to have that same exposure, you might as well be in the equity that can go up. And I just remember, like, some people had, I mean, one guy had $8 million invested in Timbercorp ordinary shares and the income securities.
Wow.
And you could almost, like, you could see the tears in his eyes. And he wasn't the only one. Other people had many, many millions of dollars. And again, it's that reaching for yield at the end of a cycle that you can see it everywhere. I can see it in the prices of hybrids. I can see it in the share prices of infrastructure stocks. You know, and there's also, you know, people taking on properties they can't really afford if anything changes in their financial situation. It's across the board because interest rates are so low and people want to maintain those 10 or 15% annualised returns. And that's, I think, the real thing you've got to be careful with these quantitative easing and low interest rate monetary policies, is that the idea is to push people out on the risk curve to get those returns that they can't get.
Very effective.
And it has. And now we're starting to see that turn, and that's why you're seeing emerging markets get hit first, because they're the riskiest on sort of on the outer rings, if you like. But over time, the more the US lifts interest rates, the more that pressure is going to come to the core.
And it's really interesting. So you talk about everyone's moved out the risk curve, and now pressures are increasing to move back in. Let's call it that. Pressures are increasing. It's becoming increasingly obvious that the party can't go on forever. Trump's having a fight with the Fed, which is always interesting to watch. very interesting to see how that one plays out. So coming back to the core, so a lot of investors in Australia, and certainly NabTrade investors, have started looking to international equities. And by international, I mean US. So 90% of our international trading is in the US. They'll buy the S&P 500 or they'll start buying the big tech names, and they've had extraordinary growth from that. Like, that's been a fabulous move for most of them. But we can see it turning. We also saw it turning in February though, right? And we had exactly the same conversation back in February. Is this the beginning of the end? Or is it just a bit of a wobble when everyone went, whew, we've been doing very well, let's just take a break. Any thoughts on that?
So there's a few aspects there. One, funnily enough, I don't actually think the technology stocks are necessarily the most overvalued parts of the US market.
That's interesting. Okay.
I actually feel like there's a lot
Because they're pretty overvalued.
So Facebook, I actually think, is quite interesting. I mean, the main investment case there is Facebook has obviously been the big profit generator for the business over time. And a lot of people are worried about regulation because essentially these are monopolies. If you look at the advertising business there that Facebook have, Google is a monopoly in search. Amazon is effectively a retail online behemoth, a monopolistic business. And we've never seen businesses this size growing so quickly and also have so much personal data that we don't necessarily really sign off on. So essentially that's the input to their business models, and they don't pay us for it. And now people are starting to get worried because there's all sorts of data breaches and all that type of thing. But with Facebook, the share price is down from the highs. It's down about 30-35%. But its big growth engine is Instagram. Mm. And if Instagram becomes as big a business as what the Facebook revenues itself are today, then it's actually an investment that could work out quite well, assuming they get left alone by the regulators. But I think what's worse, like at least there's a growth story there and the stock's under pressure, which is the sort of thing you're looking for particularly as a value investor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are other parts of the market where people are just, they're very defensive parts of the market. And so like something like McDonald's, I pick on McDonald's a lot, even though my son works there, so I actually really love
them. Oh, bless.
I couldn't be happier with the company. And I know the multiple has come down a little bit recently with some better operating performance, but about 12 months ago, 18 months ago, the net profit for McDonald's had not gone up in 9 years since the GFC. And yet the multiple for that stock got to at the bottom of about 14 during 2009. And then it got to, like 18 months ago, it was 27. And you've had no net profit growth. And what should be a business that's facing more competition than ever as people are eating more healthy, and there's just more, better, healthier fast food options.
Brand damage to it too, I think, it's sort of held out as the problem in many cases, as it relates to health and so on. There's plenty of other bad brands out there. Everyone's like, it's McDonald's. McDonald's is the issue.
Absolutely. And they've saturated their markets. How many more McDonald's do we actually need in particularly in our big cities? And so I thought this is, to me, showing the market is pricing in what are no longer growth businesses, are very mature, almost utility-like returns, even though return on equity might be very high, but they just can't reinvest their profits to earn high returns. They were trading at very, very high multiples without the growth that the technology stocks do offer. And so I felt like they were the most worst places to invest. And what you see in the ETFs and the index funds, so I had a look at them, again, this is 18 months ago, I said, why are people paying these ridiculously high multiples for McDonald's? And there's whole heaps of companies in that space, the food company, the Kellogg's and whatever, but all the multiples have come back recently. But I looked at the ETFs and index funds, and for McDonald's appeared in, I think it was 250 ETF funds, and in 55 of those ETFs, it was a 5% position or higher. And this is where I really worry for people. Like in 2009, absolutely excellent idea, buy an ETF, buy an index fund of the US market, because everything was cheap. And you didn't need to know what the stocks, you didn't need to know what the profit margins were, or you didn't need to know anything. You just had to know that this is a really good time to buy. And if you bought the S&P 500, you've almost quadrupled your money over 10 years, which is an astounding return. Obviously, no one was there at the bottom and people suffered losses in the interim.
I'll tell you a funny story. I was in technical at the time, so I wasn't working in markets. I was talking about super and tax and social security and all this stuff. And we would give presentations, and another guy who worked in the same part of the industry as I did, and people would say, when do we start getting our investors back in? Which is not a question you should ask a technical person. They've got no idea. This is not technical analysis. This is like legislative technical. And we, between the two of us, said, we're going to make up a date, and that's what we're going to stick with. That. It's the 15th of March. 15th of March 2009 is the day you should get back in. It was a running joke between us for about 6 months. We were out by 5 days. And so there you go. Can be picks, but only if you're being stupid.
Right, so I should be asking you now when we should get out.
I've got no idea. Absolutely none. Yeah.
And so I think this is an important part of the US market. So people are getting frustrated with the returns in Australia and saying, now I'm going to shift overseas. But this is, in a sense, the worst possible time to be thinking it. And you should never be thinking about investing in something because you're frustrated with something else. It's about, is the returns compensating me for the risks I'm taking? And I think this is where the US market's got so expensive, is because these giant ETF funds were in trillions of dollars that are taking market money from active fund managers, because people are getting fed up, particularly value investors who are trying to do the right thing, and the value investors just don't own the technology stocks, which has really pulled the market along for a couple of years now on its own.
So it's that flow of passive money is starting to ironically distort the market.
Absolutely. And there's the way to describe these ETFs in particular is, in a sense, they grow as the market goes up.
Mm.
And when the market shrinks, there's going to be no natural buyer for these stocks, except for the few value investors that are left, but they're not going to be there straight away.
And they're going to wait till it really
They're going to have to fall quite a way. And I think that's when you get that big concentration in those large cap McDonald's, for example, all these technology stocks. If they start going down, I think the US market could fall really hard. I don't think we're going back to a GFC. I think that was a once in a two or three generation thing where the entire global banking system basically just stopped. I don't think we'll see that again. But Australia had actually, funnily enough, because the market hasn't been supersized since the GFC, like it's really been led by BHP, Rio and the four banks, which have actually had a fairly benign 10 years, which is surprising when you think of the China's had explosive growth, which has been great for the miners. And we've had a property boom of the size that we've got. And the banks haven't done that great, but I think it just shows how well priced they were 10 years ago already. They had that sort of high starting valuation. So I think that's good in a sense for Australian investors, where historically we say 8.5 to 9% is the Aussie market return, and we're only really just above that. So if we did 8% over the next 10 years, I think that would be in line, whereas the US market is priced for maybe 3 to 5% at best over the next 10 years. So Australia actually looks much better in that sense.
That's very interesting. And obviously there's some currency issues to take into consideration as it relates to the US market and other international markets. It's been quite a ride from a currency perspective. And most investors probably don't feel they need any more exposure to currency, I would say, at this point, having been through it all. Although we're kind of back where we started. So your point about valuations is really fascinating and absolutely true. I find the situation in the US really interesting to observe, where you've got we've had incredibly accommodative monetary policy. Now we've got incredibly stimulating fiscal policy. So the government's throwing money at everything, tax cuts, building walls, you know, massive infrastructure spend, the sort of stuff that hasn't been happening for a while. And the economy's growing really fast, but the Fed's going, well, we need to do something about this. It's going too quickly. Do you think these little wobbles at the moment are just reflecting everybody going, oh, we've got to start taking this into consideration at some point. We can't keep pretending that things will go on forever.
It's always, you only know in hindsight why the markets, it's always great to explain these things, you know, a year or two after they've gone. Oh, it's so obvious.
Yeah.
And no one really knows why last Thursday and Friday were the wobbly days, as opposed to why wasn't it Monday and Tuesday when all the same risks were there. You just never really know.
Yeah, and there wasn't any new data or anything. Yeah,
that's right. But the thing is, we know the cycle's changing, but it's, you know, people, I think Trump's got a lot of criticism for this, is that you've cut taxes at the same time that the Fed's trying to slow things down to keep the economy ticking along. Because what happens if you do actually get inflation, which we've all taken for granted for, I don't know, almost since I've you know, been a 15, 16 years old, we haven't really had any inflation. So interest rates
it was a big thing at school and uni, and yet it's never risen its ugly head at any point during my career anyway.
And the worst thing that you would want is to have inflation at the same time that you're trying to keep the economy going, but keeping those inflationary pressures down with higher interest rates. Because higher interest rates in the US are really the core of the entire global financial system. And as long as interest rates are going up there, then that means everyone's going to discount their cash flows for all sorts of bonds and stocks with a higher interest rate, and that's going to bring the prices down. Now, I actually think that volatility that gets created around those situations is absolutely great. If you're the long-term buyer of stocks, which I am and our funds are, then it's that volatility you love, because it gives you the chance to finally buy some of those great businesses at attractive prices. But if we actually got real inflation, and actually it's a bit of a phony to say that we haven't had inflation. We've had massive inflation in asset prices. We just haven't had it in the core goods. But but if you look at property prices, there's plenty of inflation there. Rents haven't gone up, but the actual cost of land has. It's not the house itself. If we actually had real inflation started taking off and the Fed then has to really jam on the brakes, well, that's when you're going to get a really serious downturn, and that would just take the knees out from under the stocks in the US. That would spread around. China's already starting to take a hit, but I think China's probably, in a way, more important to Australia as our largest trading partner. And we're a bit like the Tasmania of China.
Yes.
We are very reliant on them, and it works both ways. I mean, they're buying our property. We've been relying on them to pay that for that marginal property to keep prices up. Personally, I don't think actually having high prices is a good thing, but that seems to be a good thing for the government. Keeps them employed. So that inflation thing is a real risk. We're only just starting to see a little bit of wage pressure in the US now. Amazon, you may have seen, have just increased the wage rates for its employees.
$15 an hour.
Now the question, you actually realise in Australia how high our wages are here. We are actually pretty lucky without the wage growth. But if that really starts, if that goes more widespread and we see wages going up, it's going to crimp profit margins for one, which is going to bring price to earnings ratios down. And secondly, it'll mean Jerome Powell at the Fed will be more likely to push interest rates up higher. And no one knows where the balance is. If you look at all historically in the US, it's always been the Fed putting interest rates up by a little bit too much, which knocks the bull market over. But you don't know where it is, like which is the final feather that lands on the stack that finally pushes it down. Like, no one knows, and you only know in hindsight, but the Fed really can't do anything other than keep putting the interest rates back up to something near normal until we get it, which is why Trump's criticising, which is, that's saying it nicely, Jerome Powell, who's just trying to get back a sense of normalcy. Like, we're a long way from normal. Like, a 5% interest rate was generally considered normal, and haven't even had a recession in Australia. We're already at a 1.5. There's not a lot of ammunition there. So I think if interest rates went down in Australia, it's not telling you it's a great time to go and buy more property. It's telling you there's actually something seriously wrong with the system.
So, can't time things, obviously, but are you looking around right now and going, it's a bit of a nice opportunity to pick up some things that have been hammered? I wouldn't mind, actually, before we go into that, let's talk about China, because you make a point that we are the Tasmania of China.
I'm from Tasmania, by the way.
Oh, so there you go. So is my husband. So, big fans around here. So Australia so heavily dependent on what happens in China, realistically, certainly from a trade perspective. We've got trade issues to be concerned about because their trading arrangements with the US are going to be, or certainly under a lot of pressure at the moment, let's call it that. So there will be stocks that are exposed to that. There are stocks that are already exposed. Thoughts on how it's going to impact the market more broadly?
If you actually crunch the numbers on the amount of trade between the US and China, and then what's actually got tariffs on it so far, it's actually tiny. And it doesn't have anywhere near the impact that the tax cuts have had in the US, for example.
Yeah.
The tax cuts are about four times the size of the trade that's being affected between China and the US. The problem is you don't know is it going to continue? Are they finally going to get to the negotiating table, which I think is all Trump really wants. It's just my guess. But eventually they'll get there. But I don't think those issues alone are going to cause major problems.
Okay.
I think the bigger problems are just the debt in the system, and China's making all the right moves at the moment in trying to get, say, state-owned operating enterprises, which traditionally have been very large employers, at the expense of profits. And for example, it's now telling those guys, you need to make profits. We've got to actually produce revenue to support this debt load, and so you can actually lay off people if you need to. So that's a massive change. I'm not even sure what you call China anymore. Is it a communist country, a communist capitalist, whatever the mix is? And that is very good, but they do have a lot of debt. It's different debt. The actual individuals in China are actually very good savers. So the debt's actually quite different to Australia, where most of the debt is actually individuals. So a very different situation, but nonetheless, the debt's there, and it's everywhere around the globe, which makes this that debt much more sensitive to interest rate rises. So I'm not particularly worried about the tariffs, particularly. I'm just more worried about if the demand for iron ore comes off and we need less people. A lot of these very sophisticated operations don't need a lot of people anymore anyway.
Yeah.
But if you've just got the marginal employer loses his job, then the marginal payer for property is not paying for that property anymore. And all of a sudden there's debt problems. So the whole thing sort of unwinds. So I think it's the debt I'm much more interested in than the tariffs themselves.
So coming back to the Australian market then now, so the average retail investor that we have on NABTrade is looking at what's happening now. So we had huge volumes on Thursday and Friday when people saw what was happening in the US and started to get very motivated to look at their portfolios. But usually what happens, right? Things start moving. I've been sitting there happily watching, waiting for an impetus, and that impetus has arrived perhaps. Your thoughts on what you're doing in this situation?
So the market essentially bounced back on Friday. So it hasn't been a
in Australia, it settled down very nicely.
So it hasn't been a situation where all of a sudden there's just mass value. So valuations still remain very high. And I guess the paradigm we've been in of stretched valuations still applies. The stock that I have been buying is Reliance Worldwide. It's a company that's, it's a multi-billion dollar company, so I think people would probably still term it a small cap. But when you've got a multi-billion dollar valuation, I don't think it's that small anymore. But it hasn't really been affected by the downswing recently. It's just more probably over the last month. It came out and was basically announced a forecast that was essentially in line as opposed to being more optimistic than what people thought, so the share price has come off a little bit. But this is there's a few things that I really look for in businesses that I really want to own business for the next 10 or 20 years. The more I can find of those businesses, you know, like the CSLs of the world, then the less work I have to do to find new ones, and the better the returns are, and the less tax our clients have to pay. And it just makes sense from all points of view. So this is one with a big family interest in the business, and I'm always looking for founders who run the business. I'll pick on Mike Smith here, but he's a classic example of what I call the corporate CEO. He was backed by the board. They said, we're going to do the Asian expansion. And I got criticised all the time for saying, you don't need to own ANZ and NAB, just own Westpac, Macquarie and CBA. They'll be fine. It probably won't work. ANZ's not an oligopoly. Criticised, no, you need to own all four. This is great. And of course it didn't work. And the only person that got rich out of it was Mike Smith, who bought his $14 million home down on the coast in Victoria and left with the golden handshake. As an investor, I absolutely hate that situation, because most of the time these things don't work. But a CEO in that situation is motivated by a short-term incentive plan. So it's a case of heads he wins, tails he doesn't lose. So when I find the family and founders running these businesses, they've got their own wealth on the line. They're highly motivated, they think very long term, and they don't take these big risks with the business. And so Reliance Worldwide is essentially a plumbing company. It provides the plumbing behind the wall, the stuff that you don't see. So not the taps and fixtures, that sort of stuff. It's
not the pretty stuff.
That's right. Stuff that I wouldn't know how to use.
Anyway, yeah,
me too. How to fix. And in the past, it's always been the case. It's been metal stuff, and you actually had to get in there with a hacksaw when you had a leak, saw it out, and then weld back in the new piece. And so essentially what Reliance do is they've got metal and plastic pieces, a bit like the same sort of idea as the, remember the hose in the backyard when your kid would run around, it would always be busted with a leak, but you'd have that push to connect system. So they do that, but actually, you know, a lot more higher quality stuff that's not going to break. And so they've been doing that for a long time. They're the number one in Australia, the number one in the US, and now the number one in the UK with a recent acquisition. Again, I get worried about foreign acquisitions, but I like the business they've bought, and I think they're motivated to get it to work, and it seems to be sensible. Europe, they've barely scratched the surface, but just the underlying, so this is a company that trades on a PE of like 25, like it's not bargain bin stuff. But I think this is a business that can grow earnings for 12 or 13% for the next 15 or 20 years. And I know from history that's what the CSLs have done. They've just been consistent, high growers, and eventually that multiple comes down or even comes down fairly quickly. But it's, the market's only really ever looking 12 months ahead.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think 5 years ahead, 10 years ahead. And it's that compounding that people underestimate. It's what the sell side underestimate, because they're not really thinking ahead that far. And their clients are just thinking, what can I buy for the next 12 months? And as Albert Einstein said, the magic of compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. and he said, I think it was him that also said, if you're not earning it, you're paying it.
So this
is the business I'm looking for. Again, there's some risk around the acquisition, but it hasn't risked the business in the sense it hasn't taken on a whole heap of debt just to make the acquisition. It's raised equity as well, so that's smart and conservative. And it's a business I like because a lot of the revenue is repairs and maintenance. And if you have a look at the housing stock around the world, most homes are very old and they haven't had the plumbing fixed. So they don't have these new fixtures in there. So it's just going to produce steady demand for a long time to come. Again, it's not a 10 times PER like a value investor might like, but I think it's just got that consistency of earnings that's going to bring that price earnings ratio down pretty quickly.
Nathan, any final tips or thoughts for investors?
I'd say just again, stick to quality, but if people like small caps, one that I like, and this, I'm talking my own book here, I just think it's an interesting idea. It's certainly not going to be for everyone. We own it in a couple of our funds. It's called Frontier Digital Ventures.
Mm.
And the company, basically its biggest asset at the moment is the REA Group of Pakistan. So this is not a place where I've gone on the ground and done a lot of homework, and I don't intend to. But it's run by a guy called Sean De Gregorio, and he used to work at REA Group.
Mm.
He then left there and went to iProperty Group, and he was responsible for the amazing share price performance at iProperty, which got sold, essentially sold back to REA Group. And this is really his own vehicle or his chance to actually really make some real money. Probably won't get him on the BR Rich 200 list, but it'll get him on the way. And so he's got his own money on the line here, which is what I absolutely want, particularly when you're operating in markets like Pakistan.
Yeah.
But to give you a little bit of an example of what the maths looks like, and actually I should say, the company's called Zameen.
Mm.
So have a look on the website if you're into that Zameen, Z-A-M-E-E-N, and you won't believe the quality of the homes. They'd be nicely sit there in Vaucluse or somewhere.
Yeah, wow, okay.
There. Some very nice homes.
Do some research.
So there are plenty, there's 190 million people in Pakistan, and they're all starting to get mobile phones, they're all getting on the internet, and this is all the stuff that we've seen works extremely well for these online classified portals or platforms. And at the moment, Zameen's doubling revenue every year. So it's a big multiple that the business trades on. It's like 10 times revenue.
Mm.
That's not earnings, that's revenue.
Mm.
But that's generally what these sort of companies trade on, because the financial economics are incredible. But it's growing revenue at essentially doubling every year. And at the moment, if you look at Frontier Digital Ventures in total, it has about $20 million of cash in the bank, which I expect will get invested in similar companies to Zameen.
Mm.
So it owns 15 companies like Zameen, but 13 or 14 of them are nowhere near the size of what Zameen is. So they're all growing, they're all in emerging markets. Again, we know what the economics of these look like. And you can buy the entire stock at the moment for essentially all the value of just what Zameen is in the cash. And you're basically getting the other 13 or 14 companies for free. So it's a very small company. It's only $100 million market cap. No one's really following it. In fact, it's mostly in Pakistan at the moment. It's a big asset.
Yeah.
It's going to put people off.
Mm.
But if you're looking for those sort of companies that can grow over the next 5 to 10 years and become, you know, grow tenfold in the future, like this is what they look like early on. And if I think about the business of Zameen, it's currently valued at about $300 million and Frontier have 30% of that business. Well, this is a country with 190 million people in it. And I can compare that to REA Group, which is valued at $11 billion currently in a country with 26 million people. Like, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, the economics are quite different.
But you've got to have the wherewithal as an investor to have these sort of risks.
Going to Pakistan, doing it.
So I'm very much talking my own book here, but I just think it's a situation where it's just undiscovered. You've got management with their own money on the line. Sean's living in Malaysia with his family, so I don't know whether they'll do that. He'll do that forever.
Mm.
But you've also got a value multiple in the sense that you're getting all this other stuff for free.
Interestingly enough, one of our recent podcasts we did with Mary Manning from Elliston, she talked about India, and she was making the point that not just in India, but plenty other very similar economies and similar countries, that there is this digital leapfrogging going on where previously people would have had to set up a high street store as a real estate agent in order to market a property, but it was far too expensive for a relatively poor economy. Now everyone's got a phone, and so they skip the entire high street experience. And I imagine that would be true for real estate as well, right? You go from working with relatives and people you know in order to buy property to something very similar to realestate.com and Domain with 190 million people behind it.
It's actually a perfect point you've brought up, and what's happening at the moment is REA Group has essentially made all its money from advertising, and over time basically it has every agent on there, and it's just said, okay, if you want to distinguish your ad on the website, you just pay more for a premium ad and it'll stick out.
Mm.
And so Zameen's actually a little bit different, and it's sort of a risk as well because it makes the business more cyclical, but they did have just advertising. But now in places like Pakistan, there's very little trust between people who are spending large amounts of money. And what Zameen's become now is a place where people feel comfortable transacting. And so let's say there's an apartment building going up in Lahore or one of these big capital cities. Well, now Zameen's actually getting a cut on selling the properties.
Oh, wow.
So it's not actually involved in any of the property development or any of the hard stuff that's expensive. All it's doing is providing the platform to bring buyers and sellers together and potentially earning 15% clips on the property price because it's the trusted transaction place for people to do business. So these are sorts of opportunities in these countries, but you just have to be aware that when I say revenue is growing at doubling every year, it's not doing. It's much safer to do it advertising, but it's still doing it. And I just think if you look at, so I did actually a tour with Mary last year when I was working
for the
international fund.
Oh, did you?
So I know some of the stocks she likes, and they're quite incredible. You've really got to get used to looking at these very big multiples for these businesses, but they're just going to grow so quickly for 10 or 20 years in a way we're not used of in Australia. But there's just different opportunities that people think differently about these similar businesses in India, in Pakistan. Like, people don't want to transact with REA Group. Like, why would you give 15% of the cost of your property to REA Group? You just don't need to. But and there's different advantages that these companies bring. But it's just a great point. If you're looking in India and these other places, these are actually, you know, billion population, mobile phones, and you're just getting started. Have a look at what businesses work in Australia or the US. And then go and find the equivalent in India. Like, there's Make My Trip is the online, like, Expedia Priceline of India, and that share price has halved in the last little while. So if I was saying to look for exposure to India, and it's actually hard, you can't buy stocks directly there, but that's listed like an ADR in the US, so you can buy it. And they're the sort of opportunities. I think if you're looking to own good businesses for decades, you know, they're the sorts of things to look for.
Nathan, sensational conversation. Love it. You and your team produce a lot of awesome content covering all the sorts of things that we've discussed. Where do people go to find more of your information?
So I had a look this morning to see what the best part was. It doesn't really matter where you go on the InvestSmart website. It will bring up a pop-up and ask you if you want to sign up, and essentially it'll give you our insights straight to your inbox. So I'm planning to do a lot more, given I've just come back on board, webinars, podcasts, videos.
Awesome.
So if anyone wants to follow any of that, just go to the website and sign up and get those sent to your email.
Beautiful. So that's investsmart.com.au. And I will point out to NabTrade investors, and you can join NabTrade for free. We publish a lot of InvestSmart content, which is why I'm here. Nathan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Gemma. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Wealth. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.